Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. In 1833, Charles Darwin was astonished by an animal he met in the Falkland Islands. Handsome, social, and oddly crow-like falcons that were tame and inquisitive, quarrelsome and passionate, and so insatiably curious that they stole hats, compasses, and other values from the crew of the Beagle. Darwin wondered why these birds were confined to remote islands at the tip of South America, sensing a larger story, but he set this mystery aside and never returned to it. So almost 200 years later, enter Jonathan Myberg, who takes up this chase. He takes us through South America from the coast of Tierra del Fuego to the tropical forests of Guyana in search of these birds, striated caracaras, which still exist, though they are very rare. He has written about this. It's a new book called A Most Remarkable Creature, The Hidden Life and Epic Journey of the World's Smartest Birds of Prey. And it is a pleasure to welcome Jonathan to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Good to be here.
It's really nice to have you here. I found this book fascinating. It's just wonderfully weird and quirky in its own way. And I'm so what got you into this? Obviously, you have a history. You were interested in birds. You were interested in the search and patterns. So what brought you to this, A Most Remarkable Creature?
Well, when I met striated caracaras in the Falklands in 1997, I had no idea they existed. And actually, I wasn't all that interested in birds. It kind of struck me like a thunderbolt. And everyone who encounters them, I think, has this experience. It's just that very few people do. They look at you as if they've got as much right to be here as you do. They look you right in the eye, and they seem to be asking you, do you have anything for me? How can I make use of you? Who are you? What are you? And one of the things that struck Darwin about the Falklands when he visited was the tameness, not just of these birds, but of all the animals that lived there. And that was a side effect of the fact that the Falklands are just about the only place in the entire New World that Europeans actually discovered, which is to say that no humans that we know of ever visited the Falklands until around the 18th century, and not in any numbers until the 19th century. So the animals are really very innocent of us in a way that had receded into the deep past for most other animals in the world. So Darwin's account gives you this sort of first contact moment between him and these very intelligent social birds that had evolved a mind not unlike ours in some ways, but by a different route.
I find it fascinating your choice of language in just describing what you just did, of not that I first saw this bird, but when I first met this bird. So what was that meeting like? Yeah. What were the circumstances? You sound like you were at a board meeting, and hey, I'd like you to meet striated caracaras.
Yeah, well, they introduced themselves to me. It was I had a funny traveling fellowship called the Thomas J. Watson Fellowship after I graduated from college with a degree in English literature. And the Watson Fellowship funds students who've just graduated from college to do a project that they designed themselves in one or more non-U.S. countries that they've never been to before. It's sort of designed to blow your mind. And my project that I'd pitched was about human communities at what I called the ends of the earth, which are just the most remote places I could think of. I had a dim idea that in the Falklands, which just seemed like one of these incalculably remote places to me, I wanted to see what it was like for the people who lived there. But I had some idea that you could see penguins there, and that was sort of interesting because that's something I never thought I'd see in my life. And so I went out to an island. The Falklands are an archipelago about the size of Connecticut, but there are almost 800 islands in the group. Most of them are very tiny. There's two main ones. But on these outer islands, they're sort of fragments of the islands as they were before people turned up. And so I went to one of them, and sure enough, there were penguins there. But then there were also these things. And most animals there kind of regard you as if you're not important or you don't exist. But they started coming right up to me. And if you visit them, they'll try to take the hat off your head or go through your bag. Or they're kind of like winged raccoons or something. And I just thought, what is this? Like, why have I never heard of this? What's the story of these birds, and what are they doing here? And it turned out these were exactly the same questions that Darwin had had. And in trying to answer that question, it ended up leading me on this journey through almost 65 million years of the history of the Earth and of South America in particular, and then led me onto the South American mainland, where there are 9 other species of caracaras, just as interesting in their own ways, but all quite different. And tracing their evolutionary journey in order to answer this question of, like, well, what were these birds doing here down at the bottom of the world? That became sort of the MacGuffin of the book.
So what talk about that, the number of the different species of the caracaras, because even when you look, when as you describe them beautifully, but as you see the pictures, they look, many of the birds look very different. They don't always look like they're even from the same family, which I find fascinating.
Much less that they're falcons, which is what they actually are.
Right, yeah.
South America has no crows. I mean, it has a few jays, which are crow relatives that live in the tropics, but they don't have any big black crows or ravens. The things we're used to in the northern world is these big scavenging omnivorous, and I think it's acknowledged more and more, very intelligent animals. Emotionally sophisticated, you know, interested in cause and effect, tool use, problem solving, all these things that we used to think of as the province of apes. And it's almost as if the evolution produced a kind of like a crow on a falcon chassis with these birds. And I argue in the book that I think what happened was that, you know, birds are the dinosaurs that survived the Cretaceous extinctions, but dinosaurs stood a better chance of surviving if they were in the southern hemisphere, which doesn't appear to have been affected as drastically by the meteor impact that caused the extinction of most of the dinosaurs back 65 million years ago. And so I think what may have happened is that the ancestors of the falcons came up from a warm Antarctica into South America and diversified there. And one little group of them then came further north from South America and occupied the rest of the northern world. And these are the birds that you think of when you think of a falcon, if you think of anything at all, like a peregrine falcon or a kestrel or a merlin.
Right.
But that's just a sort of tiny piece of the diversity of falcons, most of which is found still today in South America, and includes the caracaras and some very mysterious birds called forest falcons, one called a laughing falcon that eats snakes. And it's a far more varied group than I had ever thought. And it turns out that recent genetic research has revealed that falcons are more closely related to parrots than they are to hawks or eagles or the other birds that we think of as birds of prey. And that kinship made me, you know, think about their minds and what the minds of their ancestors were like. And I kind of suspect that they were more like the caracaras than they are like a peregrine, which is just a very efficient and sort of single-minded hunter. But the caracaras are much more varied in their approach, and they eat almost anything. And as Darwin observed, they're curious about things that they have not seen before, which is why they were stealing hats and compasses, the things you mentioned, from the crew of the Beagle. And this, it's hard not to see glimmers of something like ourselves looking back when you look into the eyes of these birds. But as you mentioned, the other ones in South America, which have had longer to get used to people because there have been humans in South America for almost 15,000 years, they've all adapted different strategies for living depending on the environments where you find them. One of them in the tropics eats almost nothing but wasps' nests, which is a challenging food that requires some ingenuity to get at. But they all have this sort of broad-mindedness about them, and they all have when you're in their presence, you can just feel them regarding you and thinking about you and the entire situation in a way that you don't see from all birds or all animals in general.
So if you go pretty much to any city throughout the world, but let's say any city here in the United States, and you're tooling down a main thoroughfare, you'll see a sign that says world's best coffee, world's best donuts, world's best pizza. So what makes this particular bird the world's smartest bird of prey?
Well, one place where...
I mean, is that subjective, or do we know that?
Well, it's difficult to measure intelligence because, I mean, our yardstick for intelligence, the qualities we call intelligence, is usually, is it like us or not? As if, you know, we assume that we're the smartest thing there is. And exactly. When you think about that for even a minute, it starts to become kind of ludicrous.
Should have seen me try to get into the car without my keys this morning. Okay, yes, go ahead.
Exactly. And there are many different kinds of intelligence. You know, plants have a kind of intelligence. If the question is, are you well adapted to your environment? That's one kind of question. Can you live a long time? But then there's, can you solve certain problems? How fast are you able to adapt to things? Which doesn't necessarily require a big brain to do. Yeah. And there's been, you know, interesting, I feel like it's come more into the popular literature recently that there are animals like cephalopods, you know, octopus and squid, that are seem very smart, even by human standards, and yet their brain is organized in a completely different way than ours. It's hard to get inside the mind of one of these creatures. And it makes you think that this type of thing that we call intelligence is something that there are many different ways to get there. It's not just the way that we did it. Now, one thing about the caracaras that makes them really stand out compared to other birds of prey is this convenient fact that in England, there are a lot of falconry parks and falconry collections where people keep a wide variety of birds of prey and have them perform little demonstrations for audiences where they'll have a hawk fly into a perch and, you know, fly to a glove. Maybe they'll have a falcon chasing a lure that's twirled on a line in the air. But the ones that have caracaras, in addition to these other birds, have been able to get them to do all kinds of really interesting things. And the keepers who work with these birds on a day-to-day basis have been routinely amazed by how different the caracaras are from the other birds that they keep. Most birds of prey, if you're going to train them to do a flying demonstration, you have to take them through a very rote series of routines, and they don't like for that to vary. And in fact, even getting them to accept a falconer as a companion is sort of like breaking a horse. You essentially have to just force them to accept the falconer's presence as an inevitable fact of life. But people who've read H is for Hawk, that wonderful book by Helen MacDonald, may remember that, you know, she has to take her goshawk through this process called manning in order to get it to accept that she's just going to be there in its life and has to get used to that fact. The caracaras don't act like this. And they've completely befuddled the falconers who've worked with them. One that I profile in the book is a man named Jeff Pearson, who's works at a falconry park in Devonshire. And he became friends with a striated caracara named Tina, who liked to play games with him. She would play fetch and keep away. He built a series of funny devices to test whether she could identify separate colors and identify objects with colors or shapes. He could even throw a series of stuffed animals over his shoulder and ask her to go get one, and she would fetch them by name. Nemo, Miss Piggy, Piglet, and she liked to do things whether she was hungry or not, which is another strange feature of caracaras, because most birds of prey don't really want to do very much if there isn't food in it. They're either sleeping or hunting. So this Tina just sort of broke all the rules of falconry for Jeff, and she just wanted to interact with them. And this is sort of what I mean, I guess, with that word smartest. In a way, she just seemed much more approachable in her the way that she dealt with the world and the way that she dealt with people. And they were friends. Tina would call for Jeff every day if he didn't appear on time. She would fall asleep on his shoulder. And when she finally died at the age of 33, Jeff was so heartbroken that he didn't even want to know where she was buried.
Well, the book is beautiful, and it tells such an interesting story, and is so fascinating of what it tells us, that of what's out there still to be discovered and learned. A Most Remarkable Creature, The Hidden Life and Epic Journey of the World's Smartest Birds of Prey. The book is published by Knopf. Jonathan Myberg, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Be well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.